Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, slams those who called for disarming the group, saying they want to sell the country to the U.S. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces have killed at least 50 Palestinians since the start of this year. 14 Palestinians were killed in the same period last year. Also, France's President Emmanuel Macron calls for a negotiated truce between Russia and Ukraine, saying humiliation of Russia does not serve peace efforts. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah denounces calls for the resistance movement's disarmament. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says the group's opponents want to turn the upcoming parliamentary election into a political war. Addressing a gathering in Beirut, Nasrallah rejected calls by some political actors for Hezbollah to be disarmed. They said those advocating disarmament want to sell the country to the U.S. and leave Lebanon exposed to Israel. The Hezbollah leader said those opposing the movement want Lebanon to forsake its most significant tool that can help the country drill national resources in its territorial waters. Nasrallah said resistance is ready to help the government extract offshore oil and gas resources, which can easily mitigate the ongoing economic crisis.
You have a resistance, a courageous resistance, a strong resistance, a capable resistance that can tell the enemy, which works day and night on drilling and removing all the natural resources in the disputed areas. We tell the enemy, if you prohibit Lebanon, then we'll prohibit you. Yes, we are capable of prohibiting the Israelis from drilling their natural resources. We have the courage, we have the strength, and we have the capabilities. And I assure you, and I guarantee this, not one single company would dare to come to Karish area or anywhere in the disputed area if Hezbollah declared a clear threat and a clear warning in this area.
Nasrallah stressed that those calling for disarming Hezbollah are ignorant of Israel's threat. He cited Israeli massacres in southern Lebanon, including a mass killing in the village of Hula in 1948. Nasrallah said the Lebanese people resorted to resistance, realizing that the government neglected its responsibility to protect them. He said the resistance secured southern Lebanon, brought self-confidence among the people, and defeated the so-called project of Greater Israel. Nasrallah urged people to vote for the resistance group in the upcoming elections, saying there is no hope for resolving Lebanon's problems without Hezbollah. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, joined us earlier with further insight into Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's latest speech.
Well, what's significant about this speech is that not just only the fact that it is an electoral campaign rally, but basically, he is rebuffing everything that the foes of Hezbollah have been campaigning for. They have been calling for the disarmament of the resistance, and specifically, of course, Hezbollah, saying the fact that, for example, the resistance can disarm. It has liberated most of Lebanon's south, the occupied areas, and what's left should be done through international community and so on. But what Sayyid Nasrallah said today, and as usual, of course, his speeches are very much logical, you can say academic, actually presenting evidence, presenting historical facts of how everything that they are saying is not true. He totally showed, gave evidence of how the people of South Lebanon had always been suffering against Israel, even before there was a resistance, and that the Israeli invasion against Lebanon was not a response to any of the struggling forces or the resistance armed forces that were present in Lebanon, that in South Lebanon, that they began after 1978, the first Israeli invasion against South Lebanon. So that mainly is very significant part, which basically shows with evidence and statements that those foes of Hezbollah who are saying that the resistance, there is no longer need for the resistance, but he stressed once more that as long as the Israeli threat remains, then therefore Lebanon cannot uncover itself.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces have killed at least 50 Palestinians since the start of this year. The regime had killed 14 Palestinians in the same period last year. A ministry statement said all fatalities occurred in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. The West Bank city of Jenin accounted for the highest toll, with 17 fatalities, while Nablus saw 7 deaths. The list includes 2 women who were killed by Israeli forces last month, 2 13 and a 14-year-old teens, both from Bethlehem, were the youngest Palestinians killed so far this year. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories in recent weeks. Israeli forces have launched a bloody crackdown across the West Bank amid a spate of deadly attacks in the occupied territories. Palestinians say their operations are in retaliation for Israeli aggression and occupation. The European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry into allegations that an Israeli software has been used by 50 nations to spy on at least 50,000 individuals. EU lawmakers are furious that the European Commission is refusing to set up its own investigation. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French President Emmanuel Macron has called for a negotiated truce between Russia and Ukraine, saying humiliation of Russia does not help peace efforts.
Mais nous aurons demain.
We will have a peace to build tomorrow. Let us never forget that. I mentioned this earlier. We will have to do this with Ukraine and Russia around the table. The end of the discussion and the negotiation will be set by Ukraine and Russia, but it will not be done in denial, nor in exclusion of each other, nor even in humiliation.
Macron, however, dashed Ukraine's hopes for a swift admission to the European Union in a joint presser with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. He said it would take decades for a candidate like Ukraine to join the bloc. Macron also suggested building a wider political club beyond the EU that could also include Britain. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has repeatedly requested EU membership after Russia launched a war on his country in late February. Moscow is strongly opposed to Kiev joining the bloc. Russia's chief negotiator in peace talks with Ukraine says the negotiations have not stopped and are being held remotely. Vladimir Medinsky also dismissed the possibility of in-person talks anytime soon, saying, quote, more specifics are needed for the resumption. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators last held face-to-face peace talks on March the 29th. Since then, they have been meeting by video link. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has set conditions for re-entering peace talks with Russia. They include the restoration of pre-war borders and the return of thousands of Ukrainian refugees evacuated to Russia. Moscow accuses Kiev of stalling the talks and using reports of alleged atrocities committed by Russian troops to undermine negotiations. Russia's war on Ukraine started in late February to, quote, demilitarize and denazify the country. Kiev and its Western allies say the offensive was unprovoked and unjustified. Russia has celebrated May the 9th, which marks the 77th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II, with a massive military parade. Addressing the event, President Vladimir Putin said the expansion of NATO is a direct threat to Moscow, accusing the West of plotting to invade Russian land. Our correspondent Marina Kurtanova reports from the Russian capital.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страна НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the army and navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
An initial vote count in Philippines presidential election shows the son of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos has won a landslide victory and the first win by a majority since 1986. With more than 93% of ballots counted, Marcos Jr. has garnered almost 30 million votes, surpassing the 27.5 million votes needed for a majority. According to the unofficial Commission on Elections tally, turnout stood at about 80%. Marcos Jr. delivered an address in the capital, Manila, after the early results were announced, but stopped short of claiming victory. The incumbent vice president, liberal candidate Lenny Robredo, has come in second, gaining around 13 million votes. The election was held on Monday, with 10 candidates competing for the top executive post. An official result is expected around the end of the month. The British capital was the location for the launch of a new alliance hoping to breathe fresh life into finding a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. The Convivencia Initiative is a multi-faith movement finding modern inspiration in history where Jews, Christians, and Muslims peacefully coexisted. Amina Taylor attended the lunch and filed this report from London. Let's have a look.
The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims, and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish-Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that, unfortunately, there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
one of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA Black Site in Thailand. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, All of These Guys Belong in Prison, CIA Torture, described in vivid detail by psychologists. Here's more. One of the psychologists paid tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to oversee the interrogation of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, provided new details about the torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee at CIA Black Site in Thailand. The New York Times reports James E. Mitchell told a military judge during a pretrial hearing at Guantanamo that Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, a Saudi national facing possible execution for allegedly masterminding the deadly 2000 bombing of USS Cole in Yemen, broke quickly under torture and became so obedient that he would crawl into a cramped confinement box before guards ordered him to do so. Initially, guards had to force al-Nashiri into the box, but according to Mitchell, the prisoner liked being in the box and would get in and close it himself. Annie W. Morgan, a former Air Force defense attorney who is a member of al-Nashiri's legal team, told the Times that when she heard Mitchell's testimony, got the image of crate training a dog and became nauseous. That was the goal of the program, to create a sense of learned helplessness and to become completely dependent upon and submissive to his captors, she added, referencing a tactic taught in U.S. torture programs and documents dating back to 1950s. Gail Held, a former CIA analyst who advocates Guantanamo's closure, tweeted, "Imagine the hell Mr. Nashiri experienced outside of that box that made him prefer being inside it." Nashiri's attorneys, who argued that evidence in the case is tainted by torture, questioned Mitchell about what happened at Thailand Black Site in November 2002, when former CIA director Gina Haspel oversaw the secret prison. The psychologist's testimony is meant to shed light on abuse that may have been recorded on scores of videotapes documenting detainee torture that were later destroyed at the behest of then CIA counterterrorism chief Jose Rodriguez, who claimed in his memoir that Haspel drafted the 2005 cable ordering the move. Mitchell, who along with fellow psychologist John Bruce Jessen, was paid $81 million by the CIA to develop and supervise an interrogation regimen for terrorism suspects, described how the diminutive al-Nashiri was so scrawny that guards stopped subjecting him to the interrupted drowning torture commonly called waterboarding for fear the prisoner might be seriously hurt. In addition to waterboarding and other approved torture techniques, a declassified 2014 U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee report revealed how interrogators threatened to sexually assault al-Nashiri's mother and how he was terrorized with a power drill and raped. Mitchell told the court that one interrogator used a belt to strap al-Nashiri's arms behind his back and lift him up from behind to his tiptoes. Mitchell said he objected after the prisoner howled in pain, fearing his shoulders would be dislocated. The torture continued. Guards forced the shackled prisoner onto his knees, then bent him backward with a broomstick placed behind his knees. In a bid to train al-Nashiri to call him sir, the chief interrogator gave him a cold bath before scraping a stiff bristled brush from his to his face and his mouth. The Times previously reported interrogators continually told Mr. Nashiri they did not believe he was telling everything he knew, threatening him with worse treatment if he did not tell them more. The prisoner, already subjected to the whole array of CIA torture techniques, loud noise, sleep deprivation, forced nudity, wall slamming and waterboarding, insisted he was trying to remember and tell them everything. But the interrogators appear to have ultimately concluded that Mr. Nashiri was not lying. Some of the cables back to headquarters, apparently written by Ms. Haspel, described him as compliant and cooperative. According to the 2014 report on the interrogation program by the Senate Intelligence Committee. In addition to the black site in Thailand, Nashiri, who was captured in Dubai in October 2002, was imprisoned at CIA black sites in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and possibly Morocco before being sent to Guantanamo in September 2006. In 2010, he was granted victim status by the Polish government, whose cooperation with and complicity in George W. Bush administration's extraordinary rendition and torture program was later revealed and investigated. In March, human rights advocates condemned the U.S. Supreme Court's decision allowing the Biden administration to block Mitchell and Jessen from cooperating with Polish prosecutors investigating the torture of Saudi terror suspect Abu Zubaydah. The Bush administration officials who devised, approved, and implemented the post-9/11 torture regimen have enjoyed total impunity. Not only did Bush's successor, former President Barack Obama, break a campaign promise to investigate and prosecute abuses as required by U.S. and international law, his Justice Department actively shielded them from accountability as torture continued at Guantanamo.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
And Brother Habib Zata, assalamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
So, Islam and yoga. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, if we want to, unwantedly, some people around the world, even in the Muslim communities, are practicing yoga. What's the problem? Where does the problem come from? I mean, because the feeling that your prayer, your du'as, your supplications, I mean, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has to given to you, is not given, and then the yoga is going to replace it. Where does the problem come from? Is it with me not practicing Islam in a good way, in a perfect way, and then replacing yoga with namaz or prayer or something?
Well, I disagree with the opinion that you said, like with the supplication or the prayer that we have. We do not get that kind of spirituality, and then that's why people are going towards the yoga.
Okay.
This is not the reason, because it has become a trend in the Western world. Now, the problem is those who have the, worldview, the material worldview, they don't believe in metaphysic, okay? And they don't believe in spirituality. On the other hand, they have anxiety, stress, different problems in the society. So they're after peace, some inner peace.
But Sayyid, yoga is spiritual action,
I know. That's the reason why yoga has spread in the West is because it was an exercise initially.
Mm-hmm.
It was introduced as an exercise which gives you a peace. you can find inner peace. And then later, when people went after it and mm-hmm. like the research has been done, obviously it has come like it's a specific traditional thing, which is a ritual in a specific, you know, religion.
Okay.
But initially, when you look at the history of it, how it spread in America, for example, in mm-hmm. the West, it was introduced as an exercise. So they introduced it as an exercise, and later, obviously, people know about the reality. So the reason was inner peace. Now, a person who is a Muslim who prays, he definitely finds some peace when he prays, when he recites Quran, when he fasts in the month of Ramadan. You know, he has that peace, but he cannot maintain it for a longer time. That's the main issue. You know, many people, they ask, like, for example, like in the month of Ramadan, we are having very spiritual, you know, mentality, but right yes. after Ramadan, it finishes. Why? Okay. Because they cannot keep it. Mm-hmm. So this is not the reason for yes. the Muslims
okay.
exercising yoga.
Yes.
Yoga has been exercised because of being an exercise, something new,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you do not move a lot.
Okay.
We are lazy as well. Okay. We don't want to have an exercise, said, heavy exercise.
Usually, you guys sit in yes. exercise rather than yes. acting and walking or jogging or something
some
like
people,
that.
Some people like that. Most okay. of people are liking that. So that is one of the reasons. The one reason is like why people are exercising it mm-hmm. because of this. And in the Muslim world also, they are not basically exercising or trying to do yoga in order to have a spiritual level
mm-hmm.
or gain a spiritual level.
They have ignorance
level.
About the fact
yeah.
of the
they even
essence
don't know.
Of yoga.
They even don't think about this. Mm-hmm. They even don't have this mentality which we are yes. talking right now.
Okay.
They even don't practice yoga with this because when you ask general people, like, why are you doing yoga? They say it's an exercise. It's a trend in the world.
Okay.
You know, they see like people sitting on the mats and making different postures.
Yes.
So that is the main reason that they're
usually they consider as an exercise yeah. or a sports
yes.
or something like that.
So we cannot say like because people are not finding their spirituality in the mm-hmm. prayers or supplications, that's why they're going towards the yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So it was introduced because it was an exercise and people are doing some kind of exercise which has been a good trend in the world. Like it has a trend.
So what if a Muslim does, for example, yoga in the morning
I
or
said
something
that.
Like
I said that.
That.
If it is just the exercise, okay. he's doing it as an exercise.
No, and reaching peace, as you said.
No.
What if the spiritual peace is achieved, Sayyid?
No, they cannot achieve even yoga.
No, they achieve it, man.
Yoga has a long way to achieve it. You know, in the definition, I can just read the definition of the yoga. Like when they reach to it, it's not like, you know, you practice it for a month and you reach to something. You have to practice for many years, mm-hmm. at least 1 year. And in Islam, obviously, we have this, like, if you do an amal, if you do have to do something,
yes.
practice it for 40 days. You can reach to something,
okay.
as brother was mentioning about some examples. So, you know, it's the way, like, even in the definition, they have said it. Those who are the teachers of yoga or those who have started it, they say, like, when the five senses along with the mind mm-hmm. remain still and the intellect is not active,
yes.
that is known as the highest state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine someone exercising yoga for a month or two and he reaches to this state? No. You know, when we stand for the prayers, we have all thinking, all the thoughts coming into the prayers.
Mm-hmm.
We are not very much, you know, focused about the prayers.
Right.
So this has been practiced as an exercise. And even if they feel something out of it, you know, we always feel peace when we do exercise.
Yes.
For example, the person who is...
I feel peace when I watch, for example, football yeah. games at the end of the day. It's not
you know,
no,
a,
is it
a person,
peace?
A person, for example,
no,
yeah.
spiritual peace.
No, you,
spiritual
peace. You're naming it.
No,
you're naming it spiritual peace, but that is satisfaction.
Satisfaction.
Yeah, the satisfaction.
I need to. Yeah.
That's what I wanted to read.
Yeah,
that's what I wanted to read.
That's the satisfaction that yes. he's feeling. And it, this satisfaction, maybe he named it as peace, but this is not the peace that, you know, the Buddhists, they say, like, they're monks. What they say
yes.
is as the peace which they find in the, you know, yoga.
Yes.
That is satisfaction. You know, if someone is doing exercise and he has this habit and he does not perform it for a day or two, he does not feel satisfaction in those 2 days.
A question just popped up to my mind.
Yes.
How about satisfaction in this, in the idea of Islam? Is satisfaction capable of being wretched in this world? Or is the true satisfaction in the hereafter? The true satisfaction, that spiritual peace that you're talking about.
And how are you
can
sure?
Can it be attained in this world? And like
mm-hmm.
how you said,
yes.
if I wretched this in this world, how am I sure that it is that spiritual satisfaction? Why don't we say that's the devil and the demons playing
mm-hmm.
tricks on us?
Yeah.
And so how we can be sure that yoga is not an otherworldly action?
What do you mean?
I mean, getting you to into a kind of a spiritual perfection that will be usable for the metaphysical world. Because in the early teachings of the yoga, as I read it out these days, you know, I understood that it is very much like a religious action.
It's getting away. It gets you away from the from karma and from whatever negativity in the hereafter and whatever. They state that.
Yeah, but the modern version, you know, is very much, you know, this modernistic look at everything has changed the concept of yoga into something as daily routine fitness activity, which is very much different.
So from that's why you say it is a satisfaction, not the peace. You know, it's not the spirituality.
So what about the original form, Sayed? I mean, if somebody practiced it in the original form, which dates back to before Islam. I mean,
5,000 years before.
Yes. Something before these monotheistic religions and these actions, in the true sense of the word, gets you closer to the, I don't know.
Well, definition which they get, they say yoga is a skill in action, known that which is called yoga to be separation from contact with suffering. Now, imagine a person who is practicing yoga at that time, or even at this time when you go to the Buddhist, like their
the ashes,
you
know, they call it, right?
The main, part of their worships, where they worship. When you see that person is separate from the whole world, he's sitting on a corner. He's exercising yoga, which is part of his worshiping. He performs other things as well. Yes. But he never has a contact with this world.
Okay.
He does not have
That's
kids.
That's their goal.
You know, he does not have the kids. You know, this is what Islam stops us from.
Sorry, what about a person who is leading a prayer in his solitude without connecting the world?
What do you mean?
It's very much the same. I mean, for example, in your spiritual experiences, when you are alone.
That's accepted.
No, when you are alone, you know, you are
doing... You're alone for a couple of hours.
Sorry? Yeah, you can
alone for a couple of hours.
We're talking about
the...
He's totally separate from the world. You know, there are two things, two different things. When we're talking about the world, when we talk about the Islam, Islam says, like, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, when they came, like, what was the difference between Sufism and Shiism? Sufism has the same concept, like, you need to cut off from the world.
I'tizad, that's the concept of I'tizad.
So you cut off from the world. You do your thing, you reach to your goals, your spirituality. You know, we have many examples. For example, there was a lady who was a monk. She came to Imam Zainul Abidin, alayhi salatu wasalam, and she said, "Oh, Imam, I have these, these
powers
that I have got from what I used to exercise."
But I'm not married.
And Imam said, "Like, how you got this state?" Yeah. She said, "I never married. Yes. I never had a kid, husband. I was just praying, worshiping, and that's it." And Imam said that if this was the case, that if this was the criteria of getting to higher ranks and getting these powers, then why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made Hazrat Zahra Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alamin, the leader of all the women of the world, where she is the leader of all the women of the world. She's
the
mother
of life.
All these powers and more than this, where she had the kids, she was taking care of the kids, she had a husband, she had a father, she was living in the society, teaching people. So Allah has put everything in the house. He had made this in the social life, that because we are the social animals. So Islam is about being the social animal, being socializing with the people, not getting away from the society.
Adding to your answer, brother, at the end of the day, we stated, both of us, that there could be, you know, these talents, these, you know, benefits, these rewards. They can be wretched. The satisfaction could be wretched. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no doubting it. But who says that's the true satisfaction that you need? That's the purpose of your life.
Okay.
That's the question that remains up there. How do you know that this is the satisfaction? And I'm 100% sure that they don't have no answer except that this is what we feel. Mm-hmm. This is what we know. We have gained it through experience. Who says that your experience is right? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator, let's say. Let's not call him Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The creator has sent down over 140,000 prophets.
Okay.
Not one prophet I have seen has stated that you should do this kind of exercise, this kind of staying away from people and whatnot. Rather, what we see is like how my brother was stating, that you socialize, you help your brothers, you build a community, you live your life normally, like how we usually do, right? But there are some rules, there are some boundaries, there are some guidelines in this life and lifestyle. So at the end of the day, we need your evidence of proof that this is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants.
There are a couple of more examples if I can add. Like, you know, for example, if there is a person like who's hungry, when you... give him a food, you feel satisfied.
Okay.
You feel a peace inside you. Mm-hmm. Where does this has come from?
So there as a Muslim preacher...
You know, there was an animal who was homeless. You're helping that animal. You feel satisfied. You know, there are many, many examples that when you socialize in the community, when you help people, you get more satisfaction rather than, you know, being away from the society, practicing something on your own.
So
that's why in Islam, that's why in Islam also, it is very much emphasized on the worshipping in a group, jama'ah. You know, al-barakah fil jama'ah, blessing is in
the jama'ah. Of course, you have collecting yoga nowadays too, you know, they do it in a group form too, you know.
That's the, you know.
They have International Day of Yoga, you know.
If you more
that might be something wrong in the yoga teachings.
If you ask the Orthodox, you know, those who are Orthodox.
Gurus.
If you ask them, they will deny this thing because it's something individual. And everyone has to reach to their own level individually.
Doesn't it close the way of dialogue between, for example, Islam and Buddhism? I mean, negating the whole yoga or something? For example, if you want to talk to a Buddhist about the yoga and what are the benefits?
It's a specific ritual that they practice. For example, you know, if they come and they talk straightforward about the fasting or giving zakat, alms.
Because they do fasting too.
For example, like for alms, charity we have a specific... If they come and start with this, that is not the point of getting together. The main point is, you know, you want spirituality, we want spirituality. You want peace, you want this world to be in a form of peace. We want this world in the form of peace. So we need to talk about the, you know, kuliyat, we say, like, what is it? The major topics, not the minor things. Because, you know, when you get
universal
into
concepts.
The minor concepts and the minor things, then obviously there are the disputes.
That's right.
You know, for example, between us and Hindus, we eat meat. They worship cow.
Yes.
So how can you get, you know, united?
There's a cow in the middle. There's a cow in the middle.
Okay. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen.
Welcome.
Brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, that's all we have time for today's discussion. Okay. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also YouTube, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
Anxiety is never going to be fun, but it can be healthy. And facing up to it is always better than hiding. We have prepared for you an article written by Kate Smith. The piece is titled, Anxiety Can Be Good For You. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari was a professor of psychology immersed in research, evaluating which mental health treatments worked and why, when she first became aware of an uptick in anxiety. This was some 15 years ago in New York City. She says, I work closely with practicing clinicians, and I remember one of them saying, I'm seeing all these parents and kids coming in, and they're talking about anxiety the way we used to talk about stress. She added, everything is about anxiety. Back then, Dr. Dennis Tiwari believed treatments would make a difference. She says, I thought we were going to claw this back, but the opposite happened. Instead, that uptick became an avalanche. Today, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health issue in the United States, affecting 30% of adults. In Britain, prescriptions for anti-anxiety medications have almost doubled over the past 15 years, with a sharp rise among the under-25s. In the US, prescriptions have quadrupled. In 2021, a survey of 8,000 children led Oxford University Press to name anxiety as the word of the year. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, it's the word on everyone's lips, the challenge of the moment. We have configured ourselves to think of ourselves as an anxious society. We have a million great self-help books, scientifically validated treatments. We have 30 different anti-anxiety medications, but the field has not kept pace with the treatment and prevention of physical disease. None of it is sticking. She notes, I was part of the problem, however well-intentioned, until I started to wake up about a decade ago and began thinking, wait a second, what are we saying to people? The idea that anxiety is something to manage or eradicate, a habit to be broken, is wrong and actually doing us harm. It's literally a recipe for more anxiety. This is the central message in Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari's new book, Future Tense. She concludes that the problem isn't anxiety itself, but our beliefs about it and our attempts to avoid it, which are not only destined to fail, but also to make us weaker and more fragile. It's a vicious cycle. To help reframe anxiety as an ally and not an enemy, Future Tense takes a deep dive into the emotion itself. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, anxiety is very different to fear. Fear is the certainty that something bad is happening to you. Anxiety is about uncertainty. It's the feeling that something bad could happen, but might not. It's the discrepancy between where you are and where you want to be. So you're anxious about failing your exams, finding your first job. She says, anxiety is designed to feel bad. Your heart races, your blood vessels contract, so you sit up and listen, adding, but unlike fear, anxiety contains hope. Our dopamine levels increase. That's the feel-good hormone that happens when we're rewarded. The distant prospect of acing those exams, of getting a clean bill of health, or landing your chosen career is the dopamine talking. Anxiety can focus the mind drive you to revise harder, to see a doctor, to seek new pathways towards your chosen career. Dr. Dennis Tiwari says, "It's a horrible emotion. It feels terrible. But it's a beautiful emotion as well." The key distinction between anxiety and an anxiety disorder is functional impairment, when our ways of coping impede our normal life. Perhaps we stop leaving the house. In cases of obsessive compulsive disorder, we might create rituals to dampen the feelings. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari advocates treatments like exposure and response prevention, a cognitive behavioral therapy which helps patients confront whatever they're anxious about. But her biggest wish is to change her approach at a much earlier stage so that anxiety won't drift into a disorder. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, "First, it's the understanding that being anxious is not a malfunction. It's a helpful and useful." Adding, "If you wake up with that feeling, it's worth tuning in and sitting on it for a while. Why are you feeling like this?" She gives the example of her first pregnancy when she learned that her son would require open-heart surgery within months of his birth. Her anxiety was off the scale, but it energized her to do everything in her power to minimize the odds of the worst outcome imaginable. She gathered knowledge from every paper ever published about her son's condition. She found the best possible surgeon. She planned for every contingency. Anxiety helps us forge forwards with creative solutions, but there are times when there is little we can do to address a future uncertainty. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari suggests many ways of coping here. Connecting with friends and family is a soothing first step. Cultivating things that immerse you in the present moment is also helpful. She says, "Mindfulness is one technique, but whatever works for you. Exercise is an incredible way to find flow and bring yourself to the present. Music, whether you perform or listen to it. Walking in nature, I love to write poetry. Bad poetry most of the time, but it leads me to a state of expansive thinking. Making a daily to-do list can claw back some sense of control and achievement. The worst possible response is to instead stamp out the feeling or attempt to avoid it." Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says humans are anti-fragile. We only strengthen and grow when challenged. She says, "Our emotional systems are like our immune systems. If our immune system isn't exposed to germs, it remains weak. If our muscles aren't used, atrophy sets in. It's only by feeling our anxiety, listening and acting on it, that we cope better next time." For this reason, Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari expresses grave concerns over our creeping collective anxiety avoidance techniques, like safe spaces and trigger warnings. She says, "I think they're counterproductive, and so far the evidence suggests that too. What they tend to do is inform someone that they're not up to the task and that difficult emotions are harmful." Snowplow parenting is another counterproductive development. Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, "Here in Manhattan, it has replaced the helicopter parent. This removal of obstacles, fixing things before they've happened. I know it's so hard being a parent. It takes everything for me not to step in. But we have to have faith in our kids, acknowledge their emotions, show we have confidence they can figure it out. We need to help them through, not around." Dr. Tracy Dennis Tiwari says, This speaks to me. In 2020, my youngest daughter was the target of some harmful behavior at her school. She came off her phone. She caught contact with her friends. Within weeks, the schools had closed. Two, the country in lockdown. And my daughter's anxiety over ever going back or making new friends was sky high. I was so tempted to lift that weight off her back by telling her she never had to. I came close. I thought about moving house. I inquired about other schools. I researched homeschooling. But then what? At some point, she'd have to step back into the world. The kids from her school lived all around us. On social media, they'd never be more than a click away. I knew that the best outcome was the hardest, to go back. She says, strangely, in the months that followed, my daughter used many of the methods outlined in Future Tense. She filled notebooks with lists that she carefully ticked off each day. At first, they were basic. Shower, wash hair, but as she began to follow interests and find meaningful distractions, teenagers without phones have a lot of hours to fill, they became more character building. Meditate, French Duolingo, leg workout with weights. Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari says, my own anxieties brought some horrible physical effects, loss of appetite, my clothes stopped fitting. But my mind whirled with ideas, new ways to build her up. Some actually worked. She attended a film course where she bonded with a girl over a shared interest, still one of her closest friends. Though we weren't going on holiday that summer, I asked a family in Madrid, Spain, if they knew a teenage girl interested in a fortnight's exchange. My daughter returned from that trip the happiest and most relaxed I'd ever seen her. Dr. Tracy Dennis-Tiwari concludes by saying, at school, it probably took a full year before my daughter felt safe in new friendships. Anxiety brought her to rock bottom, but by sitting with it, getting through, not around, she's deeper, stronger, and so much wiser. I couldn't be prouder. It's horrible, it feels terrible, but it's beautiful too.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.